Hello and welcome back to the show. Today we're talking to Melissa Gallico, who is a former FBI analyst turned health researcher who discovered the fascinating backstory to fluoride and how it actually impacts health today. Let's dive in.
So Melissa Gallico, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. We are very curious about the story and what you've uncovered and what you've learned about fluoride. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So tell us about how did this journey begin? Like when, we've heard that you've traveled around a bit and you've got an interesting sort of professional background. What was happening in your life that led you on this journey of discovery about fluoride?
So I've had acne since I was a teenager and, you know, I went to the dermatologist and it was always like, oh, you know, it's genetic or are you touching your face or you're not getting the right vitamins? And they would give me prescriptions and, you know, they would help, but it never cleared up my skin. But through my career, when I went to college, I went to Georgetown and then I graduated and I went right into the military. And then I was traveling around a lot. I would live in different states in the US and I lived in the Caribbean and Africa and Europe. After the military, I went into the FBI and still I was traveling. I did grad school over in Scotland and I noticed certain places I lived, my skin was completely clear, just effortlessly. I didn't change anything else. You know, I mean, there's changes that come along with moving to different places. You're eating different food, but it was just so stark that certain places I had severe cystic acne. And then other places, I had perfectly clear skin. So that's started me to realize that the dermatologist was telling me, it wasn't the whole story. There was something else there that was causing my acne. And being an intelligence analyst, I was going to figure it out. So I knew pretty early on that it was something in the water because I could tell, like when I washed my face, it would be if it was going to be one of those places that I was going to have these really painful skin conditions. And just through thinking through that, you know, what is in the water? Is it lead? You know, maybe copper, you know, copper pipes, fluoride that's in the water. And that was very, I had seen reports that fluoride, topical fluoride can cause a acne-like condition called perioral dermatitis, where it's breakouts around your jaw and around your chin. And so I thought, you know, I had stopped using fluoridated toothpaste, so I knew it wasn't that, but I just thought, well, maybe it's from drinking it. Could that happen? You know, it wasn't a big leap in logic. And it was very easy to test that hypothesis. I just stopped drinking the fluoridated water. And immediately I saw such a huge improvement that I knew I was onto something. My skin didn't clear up right away because there's fluoride in so many other places that I never knew at the time. But it was enough to tell me that I was on the right track. So that's how I came into this topic of studying fluoride.
Awesome. So that I love the sort of CSI slash, well, it's not really even CSI, it's not even the
we
right
word. We watched Quantico, that TV series.
Quantico, that's it.
We're into this stuff.
That's super cool. And so I guess it was great for your skill set to start investigating something, being an analyst for the government. Yeah, what was the first thing you discovered? What was that moment like when you were, I guess, you know, I'm imagining some, one of those, like, what are they like on the movies when they have, like, the connecting points between everything?
The strings in
yeah, the strings.
On the corkboard thing. Did you do that?
No, clearly probably
it's
didn't.
It's kind of funny because have you seen Usual Suspects, you know, with the teacup? I don't know if you've seen that movie, but that's kind of like the ultimate, like, putting it all together scene
in
the movie.
Anyway, the Usual Suspects,
it was kind of like
that.
Because, yes. Because I was holding a glass of water and I was talking to my sister-in-law, who's a physician, and she lives in Polk County, Florida at the time. That's where she lived when we had this conversation. And I looked at the glass of the water and I was telling her about my skin. And that's when I had this thought, like, oh, maybe it's from drinking this fluoridated water. And the reason that is so crazy is because Polk County is where it's the heart of the phosphate fertilizer industry in the United States. And that's where our local towns are buying the fluoride from, because when these fertilizer plants, they used to just emit the fluoride into the atmosphere and it killed a lot of the surrounding vegetation, the cattle that was raised there, this was back in the 50s, would be born lame. They couldn't walk. Their teeth were falling out. And that was really the heart of the environmental movement, you know, saying, hey, pollution is bad. Like, we need to do something about it. It was from the fluoride poisoning from these phosphate fertilizer plants. So they're no longer allowed to just emit fluoride into the atmosphere. And now they have to scrub it. They use these wet scrubbers to like capture the fluoride, and they sell it to local water suppliers and they put it in the water. It's a very hazardous material. It's really dangerous for our water workers to even be working with it. But the heart of that industry is in Polk County, where I had this idea, like maybe it's the fluoride in the water that's causing my acne.
Interesting. So it's obviously a super controversial topic. And, you know, it's from all sorts of crazy, you know, the crazy conspiracy circle side of things tends to grab hold of it and draw all sorts of correlations. I'm curious as to, as you were, you would have seen all of that as you're investigating, and as your previous role as an analyst, what was some of the best that you thought, I guess, the best evidence that you were discovering that you thought was the most credible? And like, why aren't people seeing this, or why haven't people seen this already?
Well, for me, when I first started looking into this topic, it was all about my skin. So I wasn't really looking at like, why are we putting fluoride in the water? Who is studying this? Like, why haven't they figured out if it's good or bad for you? I was just thinking, do I have a weird allergy to fluoride? And then I was just seeing how my skin reacted to it. So when I saw that I saw such an improvement after getting rid of the fluoridated water, then it was just like, okay, well, I had a flare up. Why did I have this flare up? I'm not drinking the water. And I would go back and look at what I had eaten the 24 hours prior. And I would go on PubMed and be like, is there fluoride in any of this food? And that's how I figured out all the different foods that contain fluoride, because every single time I had eaten something or drank something that contained fluoride. And so at a certain point, I was able to control my skin, like, you know, the dial on a radio, like, okay, I don't want any breakouts, and I just like fine tune it and get rid of all those sources of fluoride in my diet. So I wasn't really looking at the science at that point. I wasn't looking at any of the controversies. It was purely, how is my body reacting to this substance? And I knew it was bad, because dealing with acne for almost 20 years, you know, it's a condition. It doesn't just affect your skin. It affects your emotions. You know, there's so many other effects that go along with acne. So I knew it was not good for me. And so it wasn't hard for me to make that jump to, this is not a chemical that we want to be putting in our drinking water. Mm. And then I, you know, started looking at the science, and there is so much science behind that I was already open-minded to it because of my personal experience.
Right. You mentioned fluoride in food. Obviously, many of us are aware that there's fluoride in our water, fluoride in our toothpaste, but fluoride in food is a whole other concept. How did you discover that there's fluoride in food, and what foods contain it?
This is a really good question, really important question, because I had no idea that fluoride was in anything other than water or toothpaste. But I would have a flare up, and I knew it wasn't the water or the toothpaste. And some of the worst flare ups were from chicken products. Like I had chicken noodle soup thinking, oh, I know it's not made with fluoridated water, so I must be able to drink it. But I was wrong, because chickens accumulate fluoride in their bones, just like people do. We accumulate in our bones, and so do chickens. So if you make soup out of chicken bones, which is really popular right now, it's, you know, consider it a healthy thing to do, to make homemade stock or homemade broth. If that chicken consumed a lot of fluoride, there will be a lot of fluoride in that soup. And that was some of my worst breakouts were from poultry products, like chicken hot dogs or ground chicken or any type of like a lot of like chicken lunch meat, where it's mechanically deboned. It has little shards of bone in the finished product, and that can be very very high in fluoride. And they've done a lot of, you know, tests where they just measure the fluoride content of these products, and they're very high. And the reason that chickens can consume fluoride, not just in their water, but it's also a common pesticide, that, and the limits for this fluoride-based pesticide on poultry feed is very high, because they just assume, oh, you're not going to eat the bones. But a lot of people do eat the bones because they're making soup or they get into your food during the processing. So that's something to be aware of is chicken products. And then it's that pesticide is used elsewhere. Here in the States, it's used on grapes. A lot of the grapes from California are very heavily sprayed with fluoride-based pesticides. So if you're eating raisins or drinking California wine or grape juice, that could be very high in fluoride. There's a few more, and it was just like a trial and error process of figuring these all out. But those are that gives you an idea of some of the ways that fluoride makes its way into our food supply.
That's really fascinating. Particularly, I think, again, like with people, really unexpected sources where people would be like, hey, this is fine, and not even connecting that fluoride could be there. So obviously there's, you know, you talk to some people and they would describe that fluoride is like a huge public health achievement in terms of, you know, lowering mouth infections and things like that. So I guess some of the counter argument could be perhaps that fluoride at the right dose is okay. Like, you know, if we have too much arsenic, it obviously kills us. We have small amounts of arsenic in our food, it's okay. So what is the argument against that? And is there any evidence to suggest that even at low dosages, it's bad for us?
Yes. Very loaded question. Thank you. yeah. There is a lot of evidence to suggest that even the lower doses are bad, and it depends what part of the body you're talking about. I'm sure we'll get into this a little more as the conversation progresses. But so back to the beginning of your question about dose, you can't really control the dose of a chemical that you're putting in the public water supply. Everybody drinks water at a different rate. Some people are boiling their water, and that actually concentrates the fluoride. Some people are athletes, and they're drinking an incredible amount of water, or they have kidney issues, and they're, you know, or diabetics, and they're consuming much more water than the rest of the population. Infants consume a lot more water, like in their formula, and there's no evidence that fluoride is good for them in any way. But there's a lot of evidence that it could be bad for them. And right now, the public attention as far as the negative side effects of fluoride is really focused on the neurotoxic effects of fluoride, because there's been some really good quality research that shows that pregnant women who are drinking fluoridated water at the amount, you know, commonly added to water in the United States and elsewhere, have offspring with lowered IQ. So they've been able to measure it just by doing these big epidemiological studies and show that it is having an effect on children's neurodevelopment. So that's a serious side effect when you're looking at, you know, your IQ determines, you know, how much money you'll make throughout your lifetime and how successful a country is going to be, like, GDP wise. And, you know, so it really is a big deal, even if you're just talking a few percentage points. I mean, some of the dentists I've seen on Twitter are like, oh, it's just a few points, you know, but that really has a big impact on a society and from generation to generation. And it all is also a pretty bad indicator of, you know, what other damage is this chemical doing? You know, that's really the first time that they've even studied prenatal effects of fluoride. And we've been putting it in the water for 70 years. So that is a really bad sign right there that we're just discovering this now.
Fascinating, particularly that last study, because when we filmed our Healing Key series and we're looking at endocrine disrupting chemicals, it's now, you now look that we're actually the kids, it'll be the one of the first few new generations that is going to be, you know, just a lowered IQ than their parents, which has a devastating impact on a country and its GDP and productivity. Even a few percentage points in IQ drop, which is really interesting. So is fluoride, it's obviously not labeled currently, otherwise there'll be a huge uproar. Is it labeled, you know, as a potential endocrine disruptor or some form of hormonal disruption? Is there something that in your studies that you've seen that could lead it in that direction?
Yes, definitely. There's in 2006, the National Research Council did a whole study on fluoride, and they were looking more at the EPA's maximum contaminant level for fluoride, which is 4 parts per million, whereas the amount they add in water is 0.7. So it's significantly lower than that. But anyway, they were looking at the negative, all the research on the negative effects of fluoride. And there's a whole chapter on fluoride as an endocrine disruptor. And the interesting thing, it's available online. If you want to read it, you can just look up 2006 NRC fluoride and it should come up. But the chapter on the endocrine disruptors is really interesting, but just because of how little we know, like they keep saying, we haven't studied this and we haven't studied that. For example, fluoride, the highest concentrations of fluoride in the human body have been found in the pineal gland, which we know is responsible for melatonin and all different kinds of, hormonal functions that, we depend on a daily basis. And so with fluoride accumulating in that organ, how is that affecting sleep? And, does it have any impact on adolescence and things like that? But we haven't looked at that in the 70 years that we've been putting fluoride in the water. So that is something that I think is just, it's kind of mind blowing. It was a graduate student in the UK who even discovered that there were such high concentrations of fluoride in the pineal gland. So, why isn't the US studying that? And the other big one, as far as endocrine disruptors, is the thyroid, which is usually what people think of when they think of fluoride, because there's a lot of indications that it contributes to hypothyroidism in particular. A long time ago, maybe like 70 years ago, that doctors used to use fluoride to lower thyroid function. They would either give people oral fluoride tablets or put them in a bath of heavily fluoridated water, trying to lower their thyroid function. Well, now we have this epidemic of hypothyroidism and we're putting a thyroid depressant in the water supply. So, how is that related? And it's just, it's really concerning that we don't have a good picture of how fluoride is affecting the endocrine system.
Thank you for sharing. So I'd love to talk about some more symptoms, I suppose, of fluoride, or what people might not notice could be a symptom of too much fluoride in a system. So you obviously had experience acne. We know there's some indications of potentially lower IQ, thyroid dysfunction. What else maybe should someone be aware of?
So there are the acute symptoms like I have, where I have that reaction within 24 hours. And then there's long-term symptoms. I have this Facebook group for people who are, hypersensitive to fluoride. And there's all kinds of reactions that people have. Migraines is one that you might never think about fluoride triggering migraines, but that's a definite one for some of the people in the group. Chronic hives is another one. There's one woman in the group who went off fluoride because of her skin, and her son's Tourette syndrome just stopped. His tics just went away. So there, clearly fluoride was triggering that reaction somehow in him. And she said she's, noticed it come back when he goes to this daycare that had fluoride, where he was drinking fluoridated water, it came back. And then, so there's a very clear relationship for her that was being triggered by fluoride. And then a lot of people have a gastrointestinal upset, especially if you're drinking fluoridated water, like on an empty stomach or something. It can cause just an immediate nausea, those kind of gastrointestinal problems. And then the more long-term symptoms, that would be like thyroid issues. A lot of joint and bone problems could possibly be early stages of skeletal fluorosis, which is a very well-documented condition from too much fluoride accumulating in your skeletal system. And it's common in parts of the world where they have a lot of fluoride naturally in their water, like India and China. But who knows if that is actually happening in the United States, just at a lesser level, because we're not really tracking that. It could be that older people who are suffering, they think it's arthritis. It could be early skeletal fluorosis.
Interesting. So one thing that we discovered, again, while filming some of our series, that certain chemicals have a lot of lobbying power, like within Congress and stuff like that. So I'm curious as to what you've discovered with that as well in terms of fluoride, because if you really start, a short version of all of this is that there's very like a small amount of companies that own a lot of the chemical industry, and they actually have a huge amount of power within government. So in the example of, say, BPA, it's a very controversial, challenging thing when you have great science indicating that it's bad, but then you have all these counter studies which just delay things, like the, I guess, the previous lead story. Is fluoride similar in that regard with, I guess, industry capture or the lobbying power within government?
Oh, that is, yeah, that is such an interesting story. And I devoted this whole podcast to it. I did like a 13-season podcast to look into, you know, how did we get here? Why is this in our water? And it really is at its heart a pollution story. So back in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, fluoride was the leading form of airborne pollution. And it was all the most powerful companies in the world, the companies that were creating the aluminum for the airplanes in World War II, and they were very powerful, had a lot of influence, and they actually were like crossing over, leading the government, running the companies, leading the government, you know, so they were running the show. And so that's originally how the science on fluoride became so twisted. But at that time, dentistry was becoming a profession. It wasn't really a respected profession before that. And fluoridation really established dentistry. So these industry scientists worked very closely with the first government dentists. And so in the podcast, I go through and I pick out like the letters that they wrote to each other. And I have like the documentation from the early lawsuits where people were suing these companies for their fluoride air pollution because they killed their cattle, or the farmers got sick, and they were actually working. The lawyers were working with the dentists, and industry science were all working together to win the lawsuits and say, oh no, fluoride's not bad for you. It's completely fine, even at the low levels that we have around these factories. It's the same amount that we're adding to water. How could it ever harm you? So once the industry scientists had that accepted by dentistry, which a lot of the early dentists didn't agree with it, and they were pushed out, and the dentists who did agree with it were promoted, and then dentistry took over. So for the last 60 years or so, it's really been government or mainstream dentistry that has been pushing fluoridation. And they are a very powerful lobbying group. When you think about it, they have this army of people in scrubs who will show up at city council meetings and say how important fluoridation is for the health of the community. And then they also have a lot of influence in Washington. They're like one of two lobbying groups that has like physical buildings on both sides of the Capitol, you know, because they're just very plugged in. And then it's really hard for politicians who try to go against dentists. And you can see that right now, even with like the pandemic, where I think initially they were going to say, you know, don't get your dental cleanings. And then that very quickly changed to, oh, no, you need to still go get your dental cleanings even during a pandemic. And that was just because the lobbyists were like, oh, no, we have to, you know, we have to have this in there. So they have a lot of sway in Washington, and they're very set on keeping fluoridation because it's what established them as a profession. They just are so beholden to that idea that they rescued all of these children and all of these people from dental decay, and that it had nothing to do with the fact that, you know, we were coming out of a depression and a world war and people had dental decay because they weren't eating, you know, of all the nutrients that you need to have healthy teeth. So, and maybe there's other reasons, but I just find that the most compelling reason why we have a lot less dental decay now. And also we do get our teeth cleaned and other things that don't involve fluoride, drinking fluoride in the water supply, like fluoridated toothpaste. That wasn't around then either. Now people have that. So they really haven't studied, is it the fluoridated toothpaste or is it the water? You know, let's just do them both, you know.
The challenge with, I guess, in what we've discovered of looking at even certain chemicals, are they safe? Aren't they not safe? Well, it's sort of immoral to really do a proper study. You know, when you're like, let's like find a human baby and then bombard them with fluoride and see what happens. Like, we can't. And this is the thing. And we perhaps have animal studies that indicate that things are off. But then they say, well, it's an animal study. It's not applicable to humans. But then you can't actually do a human study. So it's really curious when you look at all these chemicals like fluoride, why they have so much power, and then why people, it's just so, I guess, you know, like the games that are played that have just go on for sometimes decades until something happens. So if someone's alarmed
there's
about
an episode.
Yeah, you go.
I just want to tell you this because there's an episode on the podcast all about how they used children at mental institutions. Like that, those were some of the first places where they fluoridated the water supply. Orphans at mental institutions, like literally. And the media exposed the part where they also used them for testing exposure to radiation. And that was a huge scandal, and the media unearthed that. And it was, you know, they, I think, won all kinds of Pulitzer Prizes for unearthing that, but they also tested fluoridation on them. But that one, they actually ended up, you know, also rolling out to the entire public. So I guess that wasn't as big of a scandal for the media to unearth, but it was an important part of the story.
Interesting. Wow. So yeah, you just keep digging deeper. It's so fascinating.
And
yeah.
Sorry, I had to tell you that because it's such a crazy story.
Yeah. So someone right now, they're concerned, maybe if their family, like, what are some of the, you know, the fluor, like, what are some of the ways that you can practically get started today to fix, you know, to at least remove some extent your exposure to fluoride?
Yeah, so it's very easy to start with your water. Just find out if your water is fluoridated. You can call your local water supplier and ask them. Usually they have a report that they post online where you can just go and look up the content of your water supply. And if there's fluoride to it, look for a different source of water, whether that is bottled water, maybe just for the time being until you can figure things out. And then you could get a filter that removes fluoride from your drinking water. Obviously, toothpaste is easy because there's so many non-fluoridated toothpaste now. You could just switch your toothpaste brand. And that will be the bulk of the story. So if you get 80% of the fluoride out, you know, you can see if you notice an improvement in any specific condition you're trying to improve, and then go from there. If you really want to fine tune it and start getting fluoride out of your diet, you could learn, you know, what the sources are there. And I do have a little a free 30-day fluoride challenge on my website, and it's just challenging you to go fluoride free in your drinking water for 30 days. But each day you'll receive a little email, and it'll explain a different source of fluoride that you might be running into. So maybe it's black tea or something. Like, black tea is pretty much the only edible plant that contains really high amounts of fluoride. So maybe you're a tea drinker and you switch to herbal tea and see if you notice an improvement. So that's an easy way to learn about the different sources of fluoride that you might be encountering in your everyday life.
Interesting. Cool. Thank you. Because we have such a thriving gut health community, I feel like it would be amiss not to ask you, what are the impacts of fluoride on our microbiome, if you're aware of any indications?
There's not a lot of studies on this, definitely not with the microbiome. There is research in the NRC report I mentioned from 2006. They do have a chapter that goes into the gastrointestinal effects of fluoride. So there are a lot of well-documented case reports about GI upset. So like nausea or even vomiting, you know, double-blind studies where the doctor doesn't know, the patient doesn't know, and drinking fluoridated water just at the normal levels causes that GI upset. So we know that it's doing something. And then your nutritional profile definitely comes into play too. So if people are malnourished, the effects are going to be much worse than if you've just eaten a meal that is high in calcium, because calcium will bind with fluoride. So I don't know exactly about the microbiome because those studies just haven't been done, but you would think it's not good if some people are having that kind of a reaction to fluoride.
Great. Thank you. So when I look at your website, I am bombarded with pictures of before and after of people with faces full of acne to clear, wonderful, clear faces. And so, like, how common is it for you with the people that you've been working with or teaching for them to get improvements in their skin from removing fluoride?
So I don't know how common it is. I actually don't do any coaching, or I don't work with people individually. I have the Facebook group and I have the book, and I'm not really into more than that. You know, I help people on Facebook and I put it all into the book, everything that I know about fluoride and acne. But when I first published the book, it was just a PDF file basically that I put on the internet and was like, hey, if anybody has this weird reaction to fluoride, this might help. This helped me. This is how I got rid of it. And I heard from so many people, and I knew not a lot of people were downloading that file. So I just thought, wow, this is really strange. This must be more common than I thought. And one woman sent me an email like, your book saved my life. I never would have figured this out. And so I thought, I need to write like an actual book and at least put it on Amazon. So I did that. I put it on Amazon. And you can see the reviews, just like random people who, you know, had acne for 35 years and it cleared up. Or I heard from one woman who had acne over 50 years and it cleared up. And she also had several other conditions that we were, you know, we're trying to figure out, like, are these related to fluoride? So she saw massive improvements in her health by getting rid of fluoride. Another woman who actually isn't too far from me, I've actually met her in person. She had acne for 30 years, I think it was. And she also had hyperthyroidism, and that cleared up when she got off the fluoride. So I don't know how common it is. All I know is it's much more common than we realize, and we definitely should study it and tell more people so they can try to figure out if that's what they're dealing with their skin conditions.
Awesome. And what do you think is the best way people can take action, like if they feel like maybe at a local county or like a small community level, what is the best way to take action? Because it can be feel, I guess, a lot of our viewers that have seen some of our stuff, it can be very overwhelming as to what's happening in government and you feel so powerless. What can you actually do to make change?
So the first thing is to figure out what rule, you know, you're living under. Some places, there's a national rule or there's a state rule here in the U.S., like certain states mandate it across the entire state, whereas other states leave it up to the local towns. So if you figure out what the rule is and then who's responsible for changing that rule, and then just start educating. There are people in my group who have been able to get fluoride out of their water just by going to their city council and saying, did you see these studies? Did you know that this is going on? And of course, people don't know because who's reading the science on fluoride? And a lot of people are just like, oh, wow, we didn't know this. Yeah, let's take a vote. Or, you know, or we're just going to take it out. We're the counselors. We make the decision. And so it really depends what you're working under. Some places it's much harder than that. You know, if you're, you know, I think Ireland, the entire country is fluoridated. So you'd have to make change at the national level. And in that case, just there's probably people already working towards that. Just find them and see how you can help. And I think just the more we talk about it, I think it's the time is coming where so many people are more health conscious now, and the organic foods movement, the paleo movement, fluoridation is not congruent with any of these things. Here in the U.S., there's a big lawsuit happening right now. I don't know if you've read about that, but the Fluoride Action Network and Moms Against Fluoridation and some other consumer advocacy groups sued the EPA. They initially filed a petition and asked EPA to ban fluoridation because of the Toxic Substances Control Act, which allows EPA to ban the particular use of a chemical like this, you know, putting this chemical in the water supply because it harms the general public. So EPA, of course, denied their petition. And so they sued. And that just went in front of a judge about a month ago. The whole trial was virtual. You could see it online. They brought in the expert witnesses, and the witnesses against fluoridation were very strong. Philippe Grandjean, who teaches at Harvard, there were just some really great testimony from scientists. And the judge right now is deliberating. I think they have a meeting like this week to give a status update. So we don't know what's going to happen, but you know, it's possible that they could mandate taking fluoride out of the water here in the U.S., and I'm sure that would like ripple across to other countries because we're really the ones pushing fluoridation. If you look at the countries that do it, it's all like the English-speaking countries that we, you know, have a lot of influence with, and then most of Europe does not put fluoride in the water. They rejected it for different reasons, and if you look at the actual reasons why they reject it, like Fluoride Action Network has a page where you can click and see the letter from that country, from an official in that country stating why they rejected it. And it's very interesting. It's some of its ethical reasons, some of its medical reasons. So it's largely rejected around the world, except for the US and Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Canada's getting rid of it in a lot of places. I think they're down to like a third of the country. So hopefully if the US stops, the rest of the world will just stop as well.
Wow. Wow. Exciting times we're living in.
Yeah. I was curious as well. Yeah. Did we just touch on the water filtration aspect? Because I think it's an important piece before we wrap up as to how do we practically get that out of our, what is the most effective filtration methods that we can use and to, you know, lower our exposure?
Sure. So the most effective method is steam distillation. So getting a water distiller, they have them for the countertop. They're not incredibly expensive. And that will steam your water and then condense it. So that will be completely free of fluoride. It's also free of every other mineral. So a lot of people don't like that option, although you could add minerals in. The next most effective is reverse osmosis. And that's also gets rid of a lot of the minerals, but not completely. And it's not quite as bulletproof as getting rid of the fluoride, although it's usually pretty good. But those are the two best ways. I've seen activated alumina filters that claim to remove like 90% of the fluoride. But just for people who are hypersensitive, like a lot of people in the Facebook group still have a reaction to that. And some people have tested and their filter wasn't working as much as they said it was. Or so just be careful if you're using something that's not reverse osmosis or distillation that you're really checking to make sure that it is removing the fluoride. So those are the two probably easiest ways to filter fluoride from your water.
Great, thank you. And so is there a place for, well, how good is the body at removing fluoride, its natural detoxification system? Or do you think there's a place for assisting that detox of fluoride?
Yeah, so the National Research Council estimates that the half-life of fluoride in bone is 20 years. So when you drink a glass of water, half of that fluoride that goes to your bone is still going to be there 20 years from now. So it's a very long half-life. Of course, there's a lot of variables that go into that. In my personal quest to detoxify fluoride, you know, I just assumed that I had so much fluoride stored in my body because when I was a kid, my dentist gave me fluoride supplements, fluoride pills. And that's when I developed dental fluorosis. And I suspect that's where my hypersensitivity to fluoride came from. So I wanted to try to detoxify this fluoride. And I went down that rabbit hole on the internet where there's all kinds of ways to detoxify fluoride. Things like cilantro, boron, tamarind, and all of these things could very well help your body with fluoride. I pretty much settled on iodine for a variety of reasons. I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to it, why I think it's such an important part of the human diet that's really underappreciated. But I did have a pretty severe reaction when I tried to add iodine into my diet. So over time, a few years actually, I figured out that if I just started really slow with very small amounts of iodine and went very slowly increased it, I was able to add more iodine to my diet. So I think that is definitely something to research. If you have people who want to detoxify fluoride, I recommend iodine and just be very careful with it because it is very good at detoxifying fluoride. And a lot of people do have reactions to iodine, which is known to cause acne. So it's one of the few things that they know, like iodine can cause acne. And I suspect it's because it is displacing fluoride from your body. So that's my theory.
Interesting. And we probably should have covered this more at the start, but I was curious when you were mentioning Europe and their, well, not every country in Europe, I assume, but their general stance in not having fluoride in their water. How are their teeth over there? Do you know? Have you had a look at into the studies, their rates of cavities and all that sort of stuff compared to the US where fluoride is so readily used?
I think it varies by country, so I wouldn't be able to lump them all together, but I think they run the gamut. I believe, is it the Netherlands that has like the best rate, the lowest rate of cavities, I think, and they don't fluoridate. I'm not exactly sure. I don't have the complete stats on that, but I know there are a few studies in like Canada, like a country, a city will stop putting fluoride in the water, and they do a quick study to show that like the cavities went out of control. But when you really look at those studies, there's always a rebuttal that says like, look, cavities were increasing before you stopped, you know, before you stopped the fluoride. So it's not, there's never been like, it's never been obvious that you take out the fluoride and there's cavities all of a sudden. I really think it has more to do with the nutrition and probably just basic dental hygiene, like the cleanings and brushing your teeth, just the physical action of brushing your teeth, not actually like needing the fluoride. But it's not to say fluoride toothpaste isn't helpful. There's a lot of other ingredients in toothpaste that could help with cavities.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for the show. And I think it's been super enlightening and interesting and intriguing. I'm sure so many people are going to be going down some crazy rabbit holes with the things that you've suggested.
Much to research now.
Much to research. What's the best way, if they want to learn more from you, what's the best way of getting in contact with you or getting part of your tribe?
Getting a copy of your book on your podcast. So where should people go?
Well, the book is called The Hidden Cause of Acne, and that's the website as well, hiddencauseofacne.com. You should be able to find the book at your regular retailers or order it online. And the Facebook group is called Fluoride Free Faces, so you could look it up there. And then the podcast is called F Pollution, so I'm there as well. It's a little chemistry
that's a cool
joke.
Name. Yeah. The nerd in me is like, ah, cool. Great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Exactly. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed speaking with you.